So, yes, let's begin with an explanation of what this is. This is Ezra Klein's podcast, and his guest this week is a guy named Illing. Sean Illing, who co-wrote a book called The Paradox of Democracy with a writer, Zach Gershberg. So Sean Illing and Ezra Klein try to give the audience a crash course in media ecology by bouncing between Marshall McLuhan and Neil Postman to describe the Donald Trump phenomenon. And yes, Lior Lerman is right. It's a total fucking train wreck.
Clinton.
Yeah.
Clinton, they don't get to Trump right away. That's not apparently what they're talking about at the beginning. They're just talking about being journalists or something. You know what I mean? I'm glad they got to Trump, but that was later, in how I listened to it. But, so Ezra Klein is a big deal. I didn't know that on the East Coast.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, sure. He's a regular TV personality. He's been, again, he had his own show on MSNBC. Before that, he was a guest on Rachel Maddow all the time, a guest on, you know, on Larry, whatever the hell, Lawrence O'Donnell's show, you know. He's a talking head pundit who they bring onto channels. And
that's a bit surprising to me.
He found it in Vox. You've heard of Vox, right?
Yeah. So look young to me, and now that he's, it's horrible what he says about McLuhan and that. I mean, really superficial. I attribute that to his youth, but he's been around a long time. He should know better about what to say about McLuhan, but I guess they're not doing that in New York anymore, so they don't know McLuhan. So we'll just nail this guy. It's going to be good.
So I know where I'd like to put forward one exhibit for context on this, and then we can open the floor to discussion. Does that sound fair?
Yeah.
Okay. That would be a section of the transcript, about 2/3 of the way through, where Ezra Klein is describing how Donald Trump uses outrage as a shortcut to coverage. So he says, I'm reading from the transcript, I proposed in a piece I wrote years ago now, particularly with somebody like Trump, who is understood so well, who has understood so well, that outrage is a shortcut to coverage. That if you do something really outrageous, you can trust you will then be able to dominate the news cycle and push everybody else out of it. I've wondered about the idea of what if the bar for Donald Trump to get covered was that he had to do something more outrageous for him, which is act like a normal politician, produce policy plans, and say something worth covering as opposed to acting like an insult comic dog. But it'd be very, very hard to try and put that into play across media. I mean, one, the media isn't singular. We don't all coordinate. There isn't, like, some grand meeting of the editors where we decide how to cover things. All right. We don't all coordinate. There isn't a grand meeting of editors. Where we decide
maybe you just weren't invited to it, Ezra.
Maybe he wasn't invited. Or, if you'll click the Wikipedia link I've posted to the... Who wants to read the opening paragraph of this Wikipedia link for us? Into the record, please. Volunteer.
Journolist, sometimes referred to as the J-List, was a private Google forum for discussing politics in the news media with 400 left-leaning journalists, academics, and others. Ezra Klein created the online forum in February 2007, blogging at the effect, and shut it down on June 25th, 2010, amid wider public exposure. Journalists later pointed out various other statements made by members of the list denigrating conservatives. Others defended such statements as being taken out of context or simply a matter of private candor. But leaving aside, I guess, the outrage was that they're doing exactly just that they
Ryan, you're breaking up.
Having a private, they're having a private door, you know, powwow to discuss how they're all going to spin the news together.
Yep, you're breaking up a bit, Ryan, but that's exactly my reading of the situation.
I think that anyone has to be careful whenever they say in a conversation that they're emphasizing that they're not doing something or that something isn't being done.
It's not like I'm, you know, yes, exactly.
Because it should invite deep suspicion that whatever you're trying to deny is actually going on. Now, I don't doubt that those kind of lines creep into all of our conversation, but as Clinton picked that part out, which I think is a good pick, it's classic that they're trying to deny what really is going on. And it's going on because it's so obvious. You don't even have to know that there's a group or that somebody set up a group. All you have to do is watch the media.
Yeah.
And
well, that's it. You see the same lines or talking points come out of six different people simultaneously, different venues.
And how it's emphasized now is that the governments and the companies have to ban people who won't say what everybody's agreed should be said, whether it be on YouTube, whether it be Russia Today being banned worldwide, and all of the associated programs, no matter who was doing them. That's clearly obvious that they were not feeding the narrative, the single narrative that was required, and this Ukraine war gave them the excuse to start going in and banning people. I mean, just yesterday, Ukraine put out a hit list of people that have to be banned, which included, I think, Tucker Carlson was on it, but certainly Tulsi Gabbard and others. They're now telling the United States who has to be censored.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but not creepy at all.
Well, they've lost the power, right? Hillary Clinton was one of the first people to acknowledge that when she started complaining about Russia Today. This is a good, maybe 10 years ago, maybe less, but where she said that the United States, she was in front of Congress saying that that America had lost its edge in terms of controlling the narrative, the news business, that there were these other interlopers, and she mentioned Russia Today in particular, maybe exclusively.
Right.
That's now, if there was one central governing communist party who was choosing who could and could not be aired, that would be better, right? Because at least there'd be a strong moral grounding and reason in ideology underlying the decisions, right, Greg?
Well, I think that there would be a... the thing is that the idea that... the West has an idea of this free press business. So that's a lot. In a communist system, you are subject to ideas that are being transmitted. If we're talking about the media, they're being transmitted over a government website or, you know, government broadcasting system or web system or whatever. There would be no other alternative because that's not how things are set up. Now, that's far more transparent than having this idea that there are all of these different viewpoints or all these different outlets presuming that they are in competition with each other in terms of finding out what the truth is or working out people's problems, you know, like these, like Marketplace on CBC or something, all these things that suggest that the Fifth Estate is going to work out all of the dynamics for you. If you're living in a communist society and you have, and you're educated, which most people would be, or have the access to education, you would be able to understand the situation you were living in a lot better than this complicated ruse that we live under. So, I mean, I think it goes without saying that if you were in a communist, Marxist-Leninist type of society, I mean, there would be only one, essentially, ultimately one source, but then that source would be the people. The moment that it didn't reflect what the people wanted or, you know, what they understood as the truth, well, it would start breaking down. And Mike, I'm not an expert about what happened in the latter part of the Soviet Union, because I'm not privy to their broadcasting there. But whatever was transmitted didn't align with their experience. And so, you know, did the people bring down the Soviet Union? Did Ronald Reagan bring down the Soviet Union? I don't know. Did the Soviet Union bring down the Soviet Union? Hard to say. It depends who you talk to. But anyway, yeah, I mean, you're sort of saying that I'm complaining about something that I want. Right? That's your idea, Clinton?
Yes, just it's interesting that the problem is, as you put it out, that they can choose who to censor and who to take down. And Hillary Clinton, said that's the problem, that Russia Today is even allowed to have a voice, right? So the one aspect of this podcast was that, well, first of all, they're talking about a book on democracy. Yeah, right, the book is actually called The Paradox of Democracy, and the author's point in the book is that democracy is conflated with liberalism, but there can be illiberal democracies. What defines democracy is everyone getting to speak openly and speak their mind and engage in conversations unrestricted, and that often leads to fascism sometimes, right? People can vote in illiberal regimes. So... So in that regard, the notion that no journalist outfit should be censored or banned, that, you know, RT shouldn't be taken off the airwaves, would be an argument for democracy. But if we were to categorize RT as illiberal because it comes from Russia, then it's not necessarily, you know, a liberalizing force. You understand what I'm saying? That's just to put it in the context of the podcast that we're talking about. So, yes.
Well, they're saying that, we know for a fact, because they admitted it, or people admitted it, that people in the Western world, or anywhere really, are not allowed to elect a communist government. The Americans won't allow it.
Right. Yeah.
And I saw a clip on Jimmy Dore where I think it was Woolsey, the CIA guy, he came out and said it, that they've got to stop communist places.
Yeah,
even
no.
That was
a hilarious moment, as if, you know, he was directly asked, like, what, do we ever do that? And of course he doesn't want to. He should have just lied and said no, because, I mean, you're a fucking liar. You're a professional liar. Just lie. But, like, he obviously felt too uncomfortable. Like, everybody knows we do that, so I can't. I'll just lose credibility if I don't admit it. And apparently he thought that it was a sort of a good qualifier to say, like, only just to prevent communism.
Well, yeah, that's their reason. That is their reason. And Laura Ingraham, who was interviewing him, just laughs at that.
Yeah.
Just thinks that's cute. That's funny. And,
yeah, well, everyone supports doing that for communism. I mean, we all know about Gladio now and we all approve, right?
Well, the thing, it's what I was saying. Maybe it was on my brief appearance last week or maybe 2 weeks ago when I said that the situation in the Donbass and in Luhansk, People's Republic of Donetsk and People's Republic of or Luhansk People's Republic, this is a nightmare for the West. That's why they're throwing arms in there so fast and furiously, because if they are a separate state, if they survive as an entity, it will be a communist government in Europe, at least as it stands now. Right. So both of them will be, and that just isn't allowed. Post-war, not allowed. So, you know, they wouldn't, the Americans or the West fought an economic battle, and other type of bad military battle to eradicate, communist governments from Europe by 1990.
Greg, wait, why? It would be a communist government? Is Russia communist still?
No, but it is my impression that the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic are communist governments. Now, what is my reason for saying that? Maybe it's superficial, but when the Luhansk People's Republic was liberated in its entirety, out came the red flags with the hammer and sickle on it. So, I mean, What does that mean? It means that they're communists. That they were always communists, generally. They were the miners and the workers in that region, and I think they're pretty strident about the whole thing. Now, Russia's not communist, but, you know, I don't know what took Russia so long to the reasons why they didn't act sooner when all this mayhem was going on there and people were being killed left, right, and center in that region by Nazis. But maybe they felt it wasn't the right time to move. Maybe they weren't prepared. Maybe they didn't have the military. I don't know. But maybe Putin is a bit nervous about, because he would know that those areas are communist. I don't know. I can't speak for where the ruling government of Russia would sit on that particular position. But anyway, they've moved finally, and but only after they tried to work things out. You know, they had an agreement signed, the Minsk agreement. That was supposed to have Ukraine give those two regions autonomous rights. And Poroshenko, the president at the time, I suppose, who signed the agreement, said that he admitted recently they had no reason that they wanted to uphold that. They were just biding their time until they could attack the place. That was what he just said. So we'll take him at his word, even though he's a scoundrel, but it makes sense. And the French and the Germans, who brokered the Minsk agreement between Russia and Ukraine, and all the parties there, just dragged their feet and allowed the Ukrainians to do whatever they want, which makes sense. So, the thing is that people should, you know, democracy means that people should be able to choose, in my view, they should be able to choose the system that they want to live under. And obviously it's not going to be, applauded by everybody, but in the West view, only their way of economics, their way of, setting up governments are to be allowed. I don't know was it on the show last week that we were talking about the can't remember how America, they, when they go into other areas, they don't put forward their system, they put forward the European parliamentary system. Was it on this show that
we didn't stray far from talking about your local library and
I didn't think so. I can't remember where I saw that. What? Anyway,
it was. I found it very interesting that you know they raised this issue that you know the problem with a democracy is that people can possibly vote their way out of a democracy and into fascism. But then, a little further on, they start describing. They stop using the word fascism when they start describing the desirability of fascism, like in the United States. They, what is this section? A little further along here, they say, I should have had this, the paragraph ready in mind. Basically say, has been asked, what does for democracy, a healthy communicative culture looked like. When he's specifically asking, so what's healthy? And he says, I think a lot depends on what you mean by healthy. I mean, for me, healthy just means stable, right? Like, not floating. But the price of that stability might be a lot of injustice, or it might mean a lot of people are excluded from political life. So, with fascism, is the stability that he's describing. But, I mean, a lot of injustice and a lot of people...
democracy.
I don't know what that's a euphemism for, if not, you know, illiberal society. So, the problem that this might happen, but then when it's like, well, what would a healthy one look like? Oh, just, you know, stable. And in order to get that stability, you know, you might have to put up with a whole lot of injustice and blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, in other words, like, they actually come around to, you know, maybe he doesn't realize that this is what he's saying exactly,
right.
But these people's, in their heart, in their instincts, they just don't trust people and they don't like democracy and they just keep talking about this, oh, when you get too many people allowed to speak, that's when, you know, not just that it goes to fascism, but oh, that's when you get this, the pattern that they're saying Trump used, you know, where you don't win by appealing to people's higher faculties and laying out your policy positions in great detail or something. You win by convincing people that you share their enemies, right? Like
Do they actually use the word fascist in this interview?
Earlier on, yes, but not in the section where they describe stability.
I'm trying to find that word. I put all of it into a notepad, and I'm trying to find the word fascism in there. I can't find it.
If fascism can emerge out of a democratic society, anything can. I mean, it's not for nothing that fascism has only ever emerged out of democratic societies. That's like a quarter of the way down.
My searches aren't working on this document for some reason or another. I couldn't even find... I can't even find a word that I'm actually using here. The liberal. Oh, can't find the liberal. Okay, it's not working. I don't know why. Okay, that's not going to help. I thought I could...
So, I mean, that just seemed like a kind of a fascinating thing. I was pretty surprised by that later on. They get around to this question, so what does healthy look like? And the guy just describes, you know, basically the more free, the less healthy. And I thought that was kind of shocking. But on a McLuhan angle, or the, you know, these guys are clearly... you can't really ignore McLuhan or something, and there's obviously, you kind of get this overall sense that this praises McLuhan and says McLuhan is important, but they also pretty much they anti-recommend McLuhan. You know, it kind of sounds like they're recommending McLuhan, right? But then the guy says like, ah, oh, McLuhan, you know, McLuhan's so hard to read, whereas Postman is just incredibly clear and, like, great. You know, so they basically make it pretty clear, like, forget McLuhan, Postman, you know, they even frame it like, well, McLuhan came up with this insight, don't only look at what's being said, but look at how it's being said, and then Postman added the insight that you have to look at the context or something. Anyway, they frame it as if Postman really expanded on McLuhan rather than kind of contracting McLuhan or simplifying it or being more on a context level. But, I mean, to me, the real, the mentality that privileges Postman over McLuhan that way seems related to their mentality of, and they talk about meeting, they're talking about communication. That's really what they are thinking of. And when he gives like a little, very quick capsule summary of, you know, the Greeks had this, and they had that organization. And then later we got the printing work that created these different forms. And now with the great film, fascism couldn't have come about with radio and film. It's like, you skipped trains. You skipped a lot of stuff, you know, like they're really only, when they talk about media, they're really only talking about communication media and, you know, acting, just the stuff on this content level that it's all about, that the important thing that media do is shape our attitude towards the content and shape our discourse rather than shaping our society. The invention and proliferation of individual motor cars, you know, that's a huge influence. That doesn't have anything to do with the discussion around political ideas and who people are going to vote for. It just mutates the society, right? So they're not interested. They don't seem interested in the side of McLuhan that is
right. Right.
Trying to bring into how any technology to society.
Right? Yes, that's right, Brian. You're breaking up a lot, but I was able to follow it. And Jess, you're right. They're looking at communications and media for how it shapes the political argument. The section you're talking about reads, this is the author, Sean Ealing, he says, so McLuhan. So he comes along and says, don't just look at what's being expressed. Look at the ways it's being expressed. And then Postman says, don't just look at the way things are being expressed. Look at how the way things are expressed determines what's actually expressible. He continues, and you're getting at this, and this is partly why Postman is more interesting to me than McLuhan as a political person, because he's really just asking, does our media environment even allow the serious public discourse? So, again, it's about public discourse for these guys, which is the heat that McLuhan is decrying at the end of Ancient Quarrel, right? All the public discourse is more heat than light. It doesn't shine a light on anything, and this postman doesn't, this podcast doesn't shine a light on anything. Because they're talking about the ways in which the shit that we argue about endlessly is shaped by the medium.
The content.
You're
talking about the content is shaped.
Right, and these are guys who sit on, Ezra Klein at least, sits on the TV all day and sits at the podcast booth and sits at Vox Media and talks about the daily political news cycle and whatever so-and-so politicians said all day. That's all his entire life is drowning in that particular political pundit soup. So Postman's more interesting to him because it's like, oh yeah, before television and radio, like Postman makes the point that, you know, presidential debates lasted 8 hours and then you all went to bed and showed up the next day. And so Lincoln talks for 4 hours and then, you know, the other guy talks for 4 hours, right? So it's like, yeah, those differences are very interesting to a political pundit whose job it is to write about the presidential debates when they happen.
Yeah.
But it's got nothing to do with media ecology, or at least not in any sense that McLuhan is understood, of course.
Yeah, even mainstream McLuhan is understood about the content that they don't get. But I want to say this, which I found interesting, that both of them confess that they think about McLuhan which is interesting because it could mean that McLuhan is ground for a lot of people today. They think about him, but they don't know how to think of him because they don't have time to read him.
Well, when you try to read Derrida or Lacan or Foucault, Foucault not so much, but when you try to read Derrida or Lacan, you're like, this is so hard, man, I'm going to have a hard time reading this. And then you go talk to some Lacan scholars or some Derrida scholars and they explain it all to you and you go, oh, okay, that makes sense. And, McLuhan scholarship cannot offer that same key to reading of McLuhan that, that these other so-called difficult authors receive. Right? Like, you know, you can't pretend to be smart interpreting McLuhan line by line.
They think he's so isolated. They think there's not even anybody you can go to.
Right. At the end of the podcast, Ezra Klein asks his guest, can you recommend 3 books for our audience? And the guy literally says, well, I have to recommend a media ecology book. Okay, here it is. Well, I have to recommend Neil Postman, Amusing Ourselves to Death. I know that the book that's been mentioned here before, because I just feel like I have to recommend a media ecology book. And McLuhan, God bless him, is so difficult to read. Postman is at least incredibly clear and accessible. And that's a very good way into media ecology. It's a way of seeing and thinking about the world.
And yeah, I get your point there, Clinton, but the extra thing is, why are they talking about using the phrase media ecology? Do the authors use that phrase? Why do they think they're engaging media ecology?
I guess somehow that's become something that Ezra Klein or his guests have been tipped off as the next best thing, the big upcoming thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. I wonder.
It is odd.
As a guy who's been talking about media ecology to no one for 5 years. Okay. Well, is there a sea change signaling here? Media ecology can have a day in 2022, later half of 2022.
I better get on top of that. Yeah, these are New Yorkers.